Welcome back to the Training Babble Podcast. I'm your host, Dave Schell. This week, I'm excited to have a conversation with Jason Koop. Koop, the head coach of CTS Ultra Running, brings over two decades of coaching wisdom to our discussion. He's not only a pivotal figure in ultra running coaching, but also a personal favorite guest of mine. Koop has penned the influential book, Training Essentials for Ultra Running, and serves as the lead author of Research Essentials for Ultra Running, a monthly publication that distills academic research into practical advice. Besides his writing, Koop shares insights on his own platform, the Koop Cast. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Koop. All right, well, thanks for joining me, Jason. I appreciate you coming back on. I think you're the first guest I had on when I started this podcast back in 2019, and it still has the most listens. As I told you in the email, you're always one of my favorite people to talk to. And I think it's because as knowledgeable as you are and as much as experience as you have, you seem to keep things very simple and kind of cut through the bullshit. And that's something I'm always really drawn to. I think there's so much noise out there. And so just like cut through this to like the simple stuff, the basics, I think is really important. And so I just recently was listening to your podcast on durability, and you'd said something. I think one of the examples you made was, these athletes that like, oh, I always fall apart after 3 hours. And you're like, well, what's your longest training run? And it's like 3 hours. And it's like, well, obviously,
pretty simple.
Yeah. And so I think that's where I want to start here is I think probably over the last like 5 years, if not longer, I think I've gotten a lot of athletes that like come to hire me and they want to do these long events that may take 10 plus hours, but they have this notion that they can ride their bike like 3 to 5 hours a week and get by on it. And so I just want to talk to you about your experience in coaching runners, but also cyclists and all types of athletes. Like, what is the role of volume in endurance training?
Well, first off, I appreciate the sentiment. I didn't know that was your first podcast episode, or maybe I just forgotten that was your first podcast episode, but I'm honored to come back on. You know, I mean, I get athletes from all corners of all the spectrums, right? I mean, I mainly work in ultra marathon run coaching now. I've always had a hand in coaching different types of athletes, from cyclists and triathletes and runners and ultra marathon runners and things like that. But they come to me much like you, from all walks of life and experience levels. And some of them have all the time in the world to train. Yeah. And time is not a limiting factor for them. They can train 20 hours a week, 30 hours a week, whether they're a professional athlete or an amateur athlete, they can do that. And those are luxury positions to have when you have all the time in the world. You can kind of, you know, from a coach, it's not, you know, not to say that everybody should have that much time, but you have a lot more flexibility from a coaching perspective when you can use the hammer of volume to achieve the adaptations that you want. That being said, there's nothing wrong with going into events and only having 5 hours a week to train. If you have 5 hours a week to train, you have 5 hours a week to train. There's right. kind of nothing around that. If your lifestyle is, if you're really trying to, like, you know, if you've maximized your lifestyle, you're super busy, you've kind of like looked at how you can rearrange your week and rearrange other components of your life, and if that number that you can allocate to training is 5 hours per week or whatever it is that most endurance athletes would look at as low, there's nothing wrong with that. That's just what you've got. It's just another right. component of training that you would take alongside their aerobic capacity and their strength capacity and their experience level. It's just one other kind of component in the formula. Now, it is an important one, and it does put a limitation on kind of the rate of growth and maybe the absolute ceiling that athlete actually can get to. But when you're talking about real people, you know, it is what it is. And certainly you can find ways to work with that in a realistic and authentic manner. And also keep in mind that most of the time these people they want to bite off more than they can chew.
Right.
You know, you want to bite off more than you can chew, whether you're training 5 hours a week or 7 hours a week or 20 hours a week. That's kind of like the nature of how we want to perform as endurance athletes, is we always want to overperform compared to either our capacity or how much we have to train or some other component that we think is a limiting factor. It's kind of built in our, you know, in our innate beings. And so there's nothing wrong with that as long as you kind of like realize the limitations. So to answer your question of like how important is volume, let's not beat around the bush. It's supremely important when we talk about endurance sports. Not to say, I don't want everybody to come away with the impression that if you're training 12 hours per week, or sorry, if you're training 10 hours per week, if you move to 12 hours per week, which is a 20% increase, you're going to improve your performance by 20%. It's not a linear relationship like that.
Right.
But if you are able to increase your volume sustainably over long periods of time, that usually results in some meaningful improvement. And we see that even all the way up to the Olympic level, where they've done any number of different case studies on some of the very high level Olympic athletes in a multitude of sports, cross-country skiing, cycling, running, et cetera. And what they have noticed is even with those experienced athletes, if they're able to increase their volume, even after decades, very sophisticated and high level training, they can still see an improvement in performance. So we have to have this push-pull with it. On the push side, we desire to have as much volume as possible and have as much capacity to train as possible in terms of hours per week or time that you can actually dedicate to training. But then on the pull side of it, we also realize that most of the people that we work with are just normal folks, and they have life constraints and time constraints just like anybody else, and they can't train like a professional athlete 30 hours a week. So what do we do within that time frame that they do have in order to make things most effective?
Yeah, and so I agree with you completely. And like I think one of the important things for me is when an athlete comes and let's say they are training for Leadville and they can only train 3 to 5 hours a week or whatever, and they're like, oh, I want the big buckle, then that might be a conversation where it's like, yeah, we're going to try, we'll do everything we can, but we're going to hit a ceiling at some point and it might be out of reach, but we'll do what we can. Now, I think the way that I've kind of approached this, and I think you would say the same thing, is like, we maximize the hours within the context of their life. And like, what can you sustainably do week in and week out? And what can you recover from so that you can continue that workload? And then the other thing for me, I think, is consistency seems to be the other piece of that, is that like, I'd rather have somebody consistently knock out 8 hour weeks than have a 12 hour week and then be like not able to train the next 2 or 3 weeks because they're so wrecked, you know?
Yeah, I think if you look at it through a very coarse, if you look at volume through a very coarse lens on the order of 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, or even 2 years, that's the right approach with it versus weekly volume, right? That's what we tend to get fixated on the most, weekly hours or weekly miles per week, which is what a lot of runners will do. And I've always felt that that's too short of a time frame for evaluation, because first off, you can manipulate it just by a single day. If you're only counting 7 days and 2 of those days are 50% more than the rest of the days, that constitutes a disproportionate amount of the workload as compared to the rest of the week, right? So that 7-day time frame just gets very, very kind of like limiting in scope. And let's face it, the only reason why we do 7 days is because that's how long a week is. It's not really all that logical, to be honest with you. You know, so like it's an odd number. You know, maybe it's a lucky number, but there's no like physiological reason that this 7-day evaluation of volume actually needs to kind of run true. So I think when we look at volume, it's better to look at it over a 30-day or even a 45-day rolling average and see what the trends are in that, much like we would do with training stress score or chronic training load or something like that. And like I said, the reason for that is from a physiological perspective, that's about how long the adaptations take to make.
Right.
Not in a week, you know, and that's what we tend to think of when we count weekly volume. Oh, if I do more volume this week, I'm going to be better the next week. And that's not necessarily the case. It's if I did more volume over this quarter, over the last 90 days, then maybe at the end of that 90-day period, I should be better than the previous 90-day period. So I think a lot of times we kind of like do ourselves a little bit of a disservice just in the way that we evaluate these things. And I do firmly believe that one of the strategies kind of around that is to just to broaden that lens out when we're evaluating volume, overall training volume, to not just look at it on the order of a week, to try to scope it out to a month or 6 weeks, or maybe even a rolling 8 weeks.
Yeah. I like that. And I've kind of been a critic of the performance management chart in the past, because I think it, with the focus on TSS and stuff like that, I think a lot of athletes try to move the needle with more intensity. But really what I like it as is a, it's a great chart for looking at consistency and progressive overload. And what is your recent training volume over the last like 6 weeks, like you said. And so I think that can be a really good indicator of, is it going up? If not, why? And for a lot of athletes, it's like, well, maybe you hit your ceiling. You only have 10 hours a week to train. Like that's how high it's going to get, you know?
Yeah. I mean, training peaks said, we don't mind mentioning this because everybody over there is good friends of ours. The fundamental mistake that they probably made in the whole orientation of their performance management chart is conflating chronic training load with fitness and acute training load with fatigue. And having those two, the acronym being synonymous with the vocabulary that you're using, CTL or chronic training load being the acronym, and then fitness being the way, the word that we would use to describe it. Those are not the same thing.
Right.
They're not. We should just call it chronic training load, because that's really what it is.
Right.
Trying to come up with a colloquial name for it, which, you know, who knows what the genesis of it was. We don't need to adjudicate that right now. But my point is just call it for what it is, right?
Yeah.
It's a 42 day rolling weighted average of training stress score. And as long as we understand that component of it, then we can go into what does it actually mean. If we think it's fitness, that's a whole different kettle of fish. We're going to evaluate it a whole lot differently if that were actually the case. So, you know, I think that for the listeners out there, you probably opined on this several times in your podcast before. If they can kind of drill it into their heads, just one simple thing is those two things are not the same. CTL is not the same as fitness, and ATL is not the same as fatigue. Just treat them as their independent variables, and everybody will have a whole lot less consternation in the evaluation of these aspects.
Yeah, it's kind of fun. I mean, just how you brought it up, right? It's like, it's in the name, chronic training load. It's a measure of training load.
That's all you need to say. You don't need to make it fun or cheeky or interesting. Yeah. Just call it call it what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. So on the flip side of that, like, I think when I first started coaching, so I think I started coaching in 2010. And around that time, there's the Time Crunched Athlete. There was also Sufferfest started to come about. I think the Tabatas were really popular at that time. And so there's this kind of this swing to like, oh, intensity, like you just need more intensity. And so now I think like the pendulum's kind of swinging back. And over the last 3 to 5 years, it's been zone two, 80-20, like all this stuff. And so I guess my first question is intensity a substitution for volume? And two, how do you work those two things together as far as like volume and intensity?
This is simple coaching 101 stuff, right? So of course they're not substitutes for each other. They do two markedly different things from a whole host of different areas. And we tend to focus on the physiological side of things where, you know, intensity improves the efficiency of your mitochondria and volume will improve the mass and the number of the mitochondria that you have, just to boil it down to one simple physiological aspect. But there are also aspects that are different just in terms of our relationship to pain and pain management, right? With a long duration effort, you're going to have a relationship with the discomfort that you have for that effort in a much different way than if you go out and you do a set of Tabata intervals, 30 on, 30 off, 30 on, 30 off until you puke. Those are two different ways to modulate your relationship with pain. And I think because of, so you've been coaching since 2010, I've been coaching since 2000, so that gives me a decade more experience. Right. We will always see some training philosophy come into the spotlight every several years. That has just been the pattern, whether it is just simple zone-based training, which started to come into the forefront, you know, in the early 2000s with the power meter revolution. And we can now better quantify what's actually going on the bike in real time in a real world type of environment, which led to, I would say, a proliferation. It certainly wasn't novel, but it's definitely a proliferation of using just zone-based training to try to demarcate the physiology, essentially. to accentuating the intensity side of things. Like you mentioned, Time Crunch Cyclist, with my which my friend and my colleague wanted to make sure I got friend out first. My friend and my colleague Jim Rutberg co-authored, as well as all of the other high intensity, you know, flavors of that. Now we're swinging the pendulum in the other way, where there's been a lot of focus, and probably too much so,
right,
on zone two and its impact, impact and performance. And 3 or 4 years from now, there'll be something else. We'll go back to the threshold craze. That seems like it's going to be the likely candidate in the rotation, so to speak. And all the old coaches like myself, and you'll be an old coach by the next time this permutation kind of comes around, we'll all look back and say, oh, this is the third or the fourth or the fifth swing of the pendulum from this side to the other side. And the thing that always rings true throughout any of those is, yes, we understand and we start to appreciate certain novel aspects of whatever is being highlighted. Maybe there's something that gets uncovered, right? There's some unique adaptation or some unique relationship with a particular intensity that is newer, right, as compared to what we appreciated a few years ago. But fundamentally, it doesn't change anything else that we have learned in the previous 10 or 20 or 30 years. So it adds to the body of information and shouldn't necessarily supplant it. And I think that that's where we get the pendulum swing, is when we think the new information is supplanting the old information, as opposed to adding to it and maybe partially modifying what we've done. We will always see coaches and practitioners that chase what comes next.
Right.
They chased the zone system ad nauseum. You saw probably the tail end of the 12, 13, 14, 18 zone systems in the 2010 is when those started to actually die down. We now see people start to chase the Norwegian method, right? Where double threshold days, and threshold is kind of the most important. I think that'll probably continue through the next Olympic cycle, because it'll be a topic of conversation that continues to reemerge. You'll always see practitioners that go and they chase the new next hot mode or intensity or flavor, because it's easy to get buy-in from their athletes about that, because it's topical. Hey, listen, I saw this on this podcast.
Yeah, right.
Because from a coaching perspective, you always have to create buy-in for your workouts. And you can do that in any number of different ways, right? You can show the efficacy of your previous training. You can articulate what the workout is supposed to do. You can point to pop literature, right? Which is what a lot of practitioners are doing. Hey, listen, so-and-so did the Norwegian method, so we're going to go do the Norwegian method. That's a way that coaches, I would say, erroneously create buy-in with their athletes with any sort of methodology that they're using. And that's not going to be, I plan on coaching for another 20 years. This is not going to be the last swing of the pendulum that we will see, and the same pattern will emerge whenever the new popular thing comes up, is people will use it as a way to get buy-in, and the really savvy people will take a step back and say, this is how this information is new and how we can alter some of the things that we've been doing for decades to incorporate this new information.
So last time I had you on, we talked about, I think it was like flattening the hype curve or something like that. And that's essentially what we're talking about, is this idea that anytime something new comes out, I think the first part is a peak of inflated expectations and then the trough of disillusionment and then the plateau of productivity. Yeah. And we see the same thing with workouts, right? And it's, yeah, you new things come out, you try it for a bit, you realize it's not the answer to all your problems. And then it kind of like goes away for a bit. And then maybe you integrate it into everything else you were doing. Now, on that note, I was reading your book again recently, which, like, I don't coach ultra runners, but I still go back to your book all the time because, again, I love the simplicity of it and how you kind of boil things down. One of the things you're talking about, I think, is, or maybe it was a podcast I listened to, you said some of your athletes will, like, leave you because you're boring. Because pretty soon after a while, they're like, they know the workouts. They're like, yeah, I get it. I know what we're doing. But it's like, that's what I appreciate about you, is like, there can be a million different workouts, but it's like really like our body has like three energy systems and there's only like so many different ways you can work on me. And so will you just speak to that a little bit about the efficacy of workouts and kind of this entertainment
Yeah. Trend. I mean, I'm in the results business. I'm not in the entertainment business. I have a podcast, right? I don't even consider it a very entertaining podcast. I consider it an informational podcast. So I know who I am and I know who I am not. I am not an entertainer by nature. And I think as a coach, our charge is to be effective first, and then entertainment might fall 10th in that whole priority list. And so you're absolutely right that, especially early on in my coaching career, where I didn't have as much kind of like immediate credentials as I do now. So now I have, you know, lots of elite athletes that I can point to, and, you know, 2.5 decades worth of experience and written 2 books and on, you know, on and on and on and on. That creates immediate buy-in, you know, to my point right earlier. I don't have to kind of like make the case of this is why you should do this workout. I still go and do it, right? But most of the time I don't have to, right? Because there's an inherent level of trust even with new athletes that I take on. But even when I was kind of earlier on in my coaching career, I was just as boring as I am now. You know, that hasn't changed. And all of my colleagues will attest to that. It doesn't mean I haven't done anything new. I do new things all the time. But in terms of the workout construction and the workout architecture, I try to keep it very, 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 very simple. As irony would have it, just this morning, I've been teaching this cohort of ultramarathon certified coaches. So I work with this company called USCA. And we create educational content for coaches. And one of the pieces of content is this hybrid remote learning model paired with in-person mentorship sessions, which I lead. And the one that we were talking about was long-range planning. And I made the point this morning that if I have a threshold block for an athlete that I'm working with, and I have 8 critical like intensity workouts that I would give that athlete in that threshold block, I might only use 3 different variations of that workout.
Right.
So most of the time I'm rinsing and repeating the same thing and maybe downgrading the volume of intensity over time, going to, you know, higher volume of intensity to lower volume of intensity. And I was using that as a compare and contrast point to, I could come up with different combinations and maybe they're just as effective or maybe they're not. And if you have a hard time creating buy-in because it's boring, you know, maybe you throw that lever a little bit with an athlete just to initially create the buy-in, but I don't have to, so I don't.
Right.
And so I don't think we can say that, you know, like this fancy workout is more effective than this boring workout. We don't have to really delineate it along that, nor do I even think about it like that. I come to workout construction through the lens of how much volume and intensity do I need to elicit the right adaptation? And then how do I come up with the right combination of intervals and sets and reps and whatever to achieve that? It's kind of in that order. And when I go through that thought process, it comes down to a very simple construction of maybe a dozen different workouts that constitute 80% of the things that I'm prescribing for any athlete, whether they're an elite athlete or an average athlete throughout the course of a year. And that's not because I'm lazy,
right?
I mean, you know, I put a lot of time and effort into a lot of components of my coaching, but it's because of what I found most effective, and I don't need to overcomplicate it any more than that.
And I always have to laugh at this because we both use Training Peaks. And so in my workout library, I probably have upwards of 800, maybe 1,000 workouts, but I probably use like 10 to 15 of them. Yeah, you know what I mean?
It's like, I'd get rid of like 900 of those.
I know.
970 of those immediately. I actually had to catalog this for another project that I was working on that you and I were talking about offline. And I was actually able to whittle down maybe 85 or 90% of all of the workouts that I would use for any ultramarathon athlete training for any race down to about like 60.
Yeah.
It's not that much, you know, and then that's like 1 hour endurance run, 1 hour and 15 minute endurance run,
right.
1 hour and 30. That's like most of them right there. Just the different like volume permutations of a staple run. When you get into the actual interval piece of it, you know, for a VO2 max set, maybe it's you know, 15 or 20 different variations for, you know, for a threshold set, maybe it's 15 or 20, it's kind of somewhere along those lines. And so my point with that is even if I could come up with all of the examples or the vast majority of the examples, it's still a really, really, really tight set.
And I think this is something I've seen, again, maybe with the advent of like smart trainers and stuff like that, is all of a sudden, and I saw this especially when Training Peaks came out with the workout builder. It became really easy to make really complicated workouts.
Yeah,
and so
exactly.
Like, if you go on Zwift, I always call it like taste the rainbow because it's just like every color and like 10 seconds here and 15 seconds here and 20. And it's just like insane, you know? And I think it's like, it keeps people engaged on the trainer and stuff like that. But it, like, sometimes I have to question how effective it is. I see it more like a spin class, you know?
And once again, if you just sell it for what it is, right? I don't think that there's any problem with that. But you have to sell it for what it is. It's probably not, it's certainly not more effective than just doing 8x3 minutes hard, 3 minutes easy, right? Which is probably the most boring VO2 max type of workout that you can, that you can prescribe. That latter workout, the boring workout, is probably slightly more effective, which maybe only matter if the athlete is really experienced and really good. You get an entry level athlete and you give them some random combination of stuff versus a really strict, you know, programming. I mean, who's to say if they're going to improve more on flavor one versus flavor two, just because they're so new, and they'll probably improve with anything. Now that doesn't mean that you can't give them the most effective training anyway, and I hope that it works out, you know, the same. But like I said, I used to have just a jaded perspective issue that, you know, all these people are just coming up with entertainment workouts, but I've kind of resigned to the fact that as long as you're selling it for what it is and not selling it for what it's not, or not selling it. Yeah. Not selling it for something that it's not, that it's fine to do that. Those entertainment workouts, if it keeps people compliant, especially in the fitness industry, compliance tends to drive most of everything.
Right.
It's not the worst thing in the world to have those things that are engaging in nature by means of having intensity variation or just lots of intensity variation.
Yeah. And I'll, so I don't sound so curmudgeon-y and old. I definitely if I know athletes are going to be inside on the trainer, I make it a little bit more complex and a little bit more engaging and throw in some cadence work and stuff like that. But I think it just gets to I think you brought it up perfectly or addressed it perfectly. It's like a lot of times it's getting the athlete buy-in. And so it's having to compete with like, how is this boring workout more effective than the one with all the colors, you know? And so that falls
funny.
On me.
So I have a perspective of, we have screened and hired and trained well over 100 coaches. Me personally, right?
Yeah.
I've been at the helm of, I was at the helm of that process for many, many years. And there's one really unique pattern that would develop, just to set this up correctly. Part of our screening and our onboarding process is going through case studies. So we would give the prospective coach, the person that we were interviewing, an actual case study from one of our athletes and ask them to produce training for that athlete for a particular phase. And then we would scrutinize it. And the exercise was equal parts, kind of evaluating where they were at in their coaching knowledge, but also how they could communicate that, because we would kind of play the role of the athlete, like, tell me why I'm doing what I'm doing. The pattern, the strongest pattern that actually emerged is that the least experienced coaches complicated things the most. They had the most intensity variation. They had the most steps of the workout. Like, step one is at this intensity, step two is at this intensity, step three, the colors of the rainbow, things like that.
Yeah.
And the more experienced coaches had this, had the kind of the simpler programs. And so when I mention this fact that a lot of coaches will kind of use variety to create buy-in, it is a very real thing. Right. And I'm not going to say that is, you know, necessarily wrong. You know, if you're a young coach out there and you are trying to get your footing, you know, into the ground and try to create buy-in with athletes, that is absolutely a part of the coach-athlete relationship. It shouldn't be your only part of the coach-athlete relationship. It shouldn't be an entertainment proposition, right? That shouldn't be the only thing. But if you're intentionally using it as, just as you mentioned, if you know that they're going to be on the trainer, you will give some variety, some entertainment value to that workout. If you deliberately know that that is why you are structuring the things you are, and you come out and say, listen, I'm doing this because this is more fun than 8x3 minutes or 3 minutes right. easy, then great. Like, you understand what you're doing at that point. You understand the difference between creating variety through novelty and perhaps buy-in through that novelty and entertainment value versus I want this pure physiological response or whatever. You could actually view that as really good coaching if you can discern the difference between the two. The problem is not a lot of people can discern the difference between the two. And that's when we get the chasing of the pendulum, so to speak, from one system to the next is because the underpinnings of those different workouts and intensity variations aren't usually well understood by the people that are chasing them around.
Yeah. So the last thing that I want to ask you about before I let you go is another thing I appreciate about you is you just call things like they are. And so as these devices come up, there's been a lot of them that come through, and like not too long ago, I was curious about a device and I was starting to consider it. And I was like, I wonder if Coops looked at this. And I like went on Instagram or something and like saw your review of it. And you're like, it's bullshit, you know? And so I'm just curious, like, one, do you deal with it with your athletes or are they typically at a level where they're beyond it? But I think it can be very tempting, like whether it's a new supplement or it's some new device or something, to buy speed or, you know, take some shortcuts. And the majority of things in my experience just don't pan out. And so how do you address that? And like, is that something you're doing up front, or how do you address it when it comes up with athletes?
It's a whole ball of wax. I mean, there's two categories of this, right? There's a supplement category and there's a device category. And they kind of boil down to like the same patterning that I actually kind of like use to evaluate it. The first thing that I ask is what is the problem that this is trying to solve? Many, many times it's in the supplement category, they're particularly egregious about this. They can't articulate what problem the supplement is actually trying to solve, or like in the case of exogenous ketones, they claim to solve them all. And when you start out with that, that gives you a framework to evaluate what is actually in front of you. Okay, if we know we're going to solve whatever, let's just say that sleep duration is important, right? That's a metric that we want to use as coaches in order to help our evaluation, right? Sleep duration, knowing the sleep duration and knowing if that sleep duration is going up, down, trending sideways, whatever. Okay, what are the ways that we can actually measure that? We can have the athlete record that. This is when I got into bed and this is when I woke up. You can just take a paper and pens, that's kind of that easy. Do the devices do a good job at measuring sleep duration? When they initially came out, they didn't. And now they do a pretty decent job. Not perfect, really? But in terms of bordering the sleep, this is when you went to sleep and this is when you woke up. They're getting very reasonable, and it's something that I would actually use. I didn't say that at the beginning because all their own validation data said that they were garbage.
Right.
But my point with that is we took a specific variable. Is this meaningful? And what does their actual validation data say about the device's capacity, or in the supplements part of it, the supplement's capacity to actually affect that particular variable? So you can take that framework and then do kind of whatever you want to with it. One of the issues though is that the devices are coming at us much more quickly than we can actually evaluate them. So there's a lot of things that I would love to get a great fix on. When heart rate variability first started becoming portable, we could always take heart rate variability, but it was clumsy. You had to have a, you know, really sophisticated heart rate monitor. You have to do it when you're at rest, in kind of in a quiet space, you know, there's a lot of friction associated right. with gathering that with that variable. So when a lot of the device manufacturers started to bake that into their wearables, they can measure it at night, they can measure it during the day. It's an attractive option. Like, hey, I would like to get my hands on this. But then you go back to the original proposition that I mentioned earlier. What problem is this trying to solve? Well, we're trying to get a fix on how ready the body is at rest, right? We're trying to essentially use heart rate variability to say at rest, this athlete is ready to perform. They're not ready to perform. They're over-fatigued, kind of whatever. Well, as it turns out, even measuring heart rate variability at night becomes problematic because you're taking the reading continuously throughout the night, of which the earlier parts of that reading are not far enough removed from the last stress of the day, which is usually a meal or even like putting the dishes away and things like that, like all those little small stresses, it starts to interfere with the signal that you're actually getting. So because all these devices and then the measurements that they can actually take are kind of coming at us rapid fire, it becomes pretty hard to actually keep up with it. And there will be any number of different variations of that kind of in the future. If I could stand on a soapbox for just a little bit, since this is a coaching podcast, I'm talking to a fellow coach. It is the coach's responsibility to weed through this. Like, let's not make any bones about it. Athletes are coming to us for our advice. And part of the counsel that we can provide is to, yes, adopt these measurements and adopt these systems, or no, do not adopt them. And there have been any number of cases out there, and I'm not going to point them out specifically because we'd be here for another podcast, where coaches have adopted these measuring metrics, whether they're baked into a Whoop strap or an Oura ring or whatever, proliferated them to their athletes, given their athletes the counsel that, hey, we're going to use your readiness score from your Oura ring or whatever it is, and then come to find out 2 years later that those scores do not correlate in any way, shape, or form with any form of readiness or recovery that we can actually measure and get a fix on. There's accountability there. And I think for the coaches out there listening, the athletes out there listening that have their coaches or that their coaches actually prescribe some of this stuff, we shouldn't, as a coaching group, have to backtrack that. We should be in front of it, not behind it. And this more recent, I produced some content on this based on some recent research just recently on Instagram. When coaching has to backtrack out of, we first were recommending this, and now the research came out and it turns out it's all full of crap, that makes everybody look bad and is ultimately bad for the athletes. And I do think that the coaches hold some accountability for this, because there have been any number of ones out there that have, especially with the wearables, proliferated the readiness and recovery scores, and come to find out 3 or 4 years later that they're not all that accurate in actually measuring anything. If you want to link up the paper that I'm referring to up in the show notes, I'll gladly send it to you. I'm sure you know the one that I'm referencing though.
Yeah, please do. And so I think last time we talked, you gave an example of this, and it's funny because it's one I was guilty of and I wasn't coaching at the time, but it was the whole either 4-to-1 or 3-to-1 carbs to protein thing. Yeah. Right. And talking about Kathy and how she had done that research and then like came back and realized after the fact, like, oh, it wasn't really the ratio. It was just people were consuming more calories after their workout. Yeah. And it's funny, 'cause I, right before the pandemic, Whoop was running a deal and I bought one and told my athletes to get one, and we like tracked it for 6 months, and I like could never find any correlation between subjective or objective measures like training load and stuff. And so, yeah, it's definitely a slippery slope. And so on that note, is there anything that you do use? Yeah. Like, are there any devices that you do use?
Yeah. So I don't want to just poo poo on everything and leave everybody like, and leave.
That's why I had you on, man.
Trust me, man, as much as I do that, I mean, you mentioned that's part of my MO, not to poo-poo on things, but to scrutinize things really well. I am a solutions-oriented person. And so if I have a problem to solve, I'm actually going to find it. So in the area of heart rate variability, since we just brought that up, I'll tell you my exact system is for the athletes that I do want to incorporate some sort of morning assessment that will give us a directional arrow on, do I need to proceed as planned or change the workout? That's the problem I'm trying to solve. We're figuring out, do we keep the training as is, or do we change the training in the morning based on something? The way that I solve that problem is I have them take a morning heart rate variability measurement. So they wake up, they're in a seated position immediately. They take their heart rate for 60 seconds. Many of them just use the camera on their iPhone. Yeah. It's very effective for not for everybody. We can't get into that, But if that does not work for you, you can just put a heart rate strap on. It's not that big of a deal. Take that for 60 seconds. And I have them run through the standard questionnaire on HRV for training. I like it. It uses a slider system. Where is it better? You know, is your soreness better or worse than yesterday? Was your sleep better or worse than yesterday? And then I use all of that to make a decision, not just one thing. I'm not using an alchemized score or one variable or some sort of decrease in heart rate variability or whatever to determine what's going on. We take all of those things in, look at the context of training, and then a human or humans make the decision of we're going to keep the training or move it forward. That is difficult framework for a lot of coaches. And I understand that because your athletes are waking up at 4 a.m. and training, and they're in different time zones, right? And you can't always be immediately available at 5 a.m. to answer their heart rate variability questions. I understand the practicality of trying to implement that system because I live it, not across my entire athlete group, but across many of my athletes where we do this type of monitoring. I get it. I get those practical limitations for the people that are, Jesus Christ, I'm going to be answering text messages at 5 a.m. about my athlete's heart rate. I get it. Trust me, I get it. I mean, I've got athletes in Asia that do the same thing, and I'm in here in the U.S. at times. So we have like framework to kind of go through.
Yeah.
But that's the system that I do actually use, is have the athlete wake up, take their heart rate variability for 2 minutes, run through this simple questionnaire, look at all the variables in that questionnaire, look at the training, and then decide to move or go forward. And I find, this is my experience, I'm not saying this is everybody's experience because it's me and the athlete changing the data or changing the training. I find that once every 8 weeks or maybe twice every 8 weeks, we're changing something. It's on that order. And sometimes it's like, yeah, this is probably not all that material, but sometimes it is.
Yeah.
And usually it's train trap avoidance. I predominantly use that monitoring system to avoid the negative. I exclusively use that system to avoid the negative and not try to accentuate the positive, meaning we're not looking at, oh my God, this athlete's in a really ready state, so I'm going to smash him with a big workout. I don't use it in that manner.
Yeah.
I use it in the manner of you got a really hard workout and we've got a few things like not going in your favor. You got a scratchy throat. You didn't sleep well last night. Your heart rate variability is a little bit off. Let's take an easy day. Like that's typically the context of what's going on, is we're trying to avoid the negative by not doing a hard workout when they're behind the eight ball, physiologically, psychologically, emotionally, all those kind of things wrapped up into it.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I'll just ask you this too. I mean, first I'll say it's funny. I think one of the nice things about the HRV for training app? Is that the one you're using?
Yeah. Mark Galtini's app. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. So it's nice because it's like, it creates a habit where the athlete's creating the questionnaire. And it's like, when I first started coaching, I had like a form, like a Google form or something like that. And I would like try to have athletes do it every morning, but it's like, it just wasn't top of mind. And so I like that you're pairing it with the objective metric, the HRV for training, you're getting the subjective with it. And it just becomes a habit where you're doing it every morning. Yeah. But then I'd ask too, is like, do you think that's more effective than just like telling athletes, like, you know, like assess how you feel after you warm up for 20 to 30 minutes, assess how you feel. And if it's just not there that day, like make it an easy day. And I know most athletes are going to try to push through and like do the workout if that was on their schedule, but I'm just curious.
I like doing it rest because it's unbiased. I mean, I every once in a while I will have an athlete there, I'm like, okay, just get into the workout and see how you feel. But I really don't like doing that. I really like taking it at rest because it's an unbiased format. You can make a decision about it in that context. And then when you get out in the workout, the decision's kind of like made for you at that point.
Yeah.
I take a little bit of this framework from a lot of like either like gym settings where athletes will come into a gym, or team sports settings where they can actually do the assessment with the athlete in person, which I think is kind of the most effective way to do it, where they're filling out that questionnaire and they're doing that baseline physiology kind of in a location. And then the coach who's in charge of that session will say, okay, this is what we're doing today. Like based off of everything that's going on, we're going to strength train. We're going to do cardio. We're going to do, you know, skills training, kind of whatever else is going on. And so I think using that as a blueprint, having this, we're doing it in the morning, we're doing it at rest, we're gathering all of that information all at once, and then we're making a decision based off of that information, I think is an effective way to do it. That being said, I want to reemphasize this again, because somebody's going to pull me over on the side of a trailer, you know, throw a freaking tomato at my car or whatever. I get the practical limitations of that. And me personally, I understand that I'm in a little bit of a privileged coaching position where I have a lot of very good athletes that have a lifestyle that's conducive to me being actually able to monitor that. That's not my entire athlete base, but it is a big part of it. And I completely understand all of the logistical limitations behind using that type of monitoring system and what you and I kind of know as remote based endurance coaching, where we're not in the same time zone or the same location or even work the same hours that that our athletes are working and training at. I get all of that stuff.
Yeah. And so before I let you go, are there anything, you know, we kind of touched on these things, like I think the theme today was kind of like back to basics or like keeping it simple. So
in everything, a lot of things, man, we went full circle.
We did. But is there anything like, I always like to ask, like, as far as one of my big philosophies or what have you is like, I'm a big believer in the Pareto principle and this idea that like 80% of our results come from 20% of the inputs or whatever. And so I think it can be nice to like boil it down to like, what do you see as the most effective things for athletes? And so over your long, I want to emphasize that long coaching career, what have you found to be the most effective in athlete performance and progression?
You know, so I think the best viewpoint or the best vantage point of this is, what do I do when I take a new athlete on? Because I'm looking at it through the lens of how can I make a difference? Like, what are some of the easy levers that I can pull to make a difference with this athlete, right? It's easy to give them a lot of work. It's easy to like start just increasing the individual intensity. It's easy to, you know, pull some, oh, we're going to just try this supplement or kind of whatever. But the vantage point that I initially take when I first start working with an athlete is I just look at what their weekly or quarterly volume is over the course of 3 or 4 years. That big of a time frame. I have them give me all your training information, and the coarsest viewpoint that I will take with that is let's just look at how the volume rolls. Within that volume, I then look at two aspects. I look at, is there a way that we can increase annual or quarterly volume? Sometimes that's by bringing up the dips. Sometimes that's by increasing the maximum amount. And sometimes it's just run rating everything. Is there an opportunity to do that, right? Sometimes there's not, right? But a lot of times when you look at it through that course of a lens, you can say, okay, listen, your lowest hanging fruit is from January to January, all of January and all of February, you're doing 5 hours a week and your average is 15 hours a week. Let's just bring that 5 hours a week to 7 hours a week. And that's probably enough to get an initial add up, to be honest. You can just keep everything else the same.
Totally.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's the first viewpoint. And then if I can't find a way to manipulate kind of the total amount of volume over the course of these long periods of time, and I'm emphasizing the long period because it's not just a week. I'm not just trying to improve the maximum amount of weekly volume, because I think that's too short of a lens to look at things through. Then I look at, how can I pattern the volume differently and achieve the same number of hours annually? If for whatever reason I'm like, you know what, this athlete's, they're kind of getting injured over here, and maybe this is enough, yeah, like adaptation for them, and they do 1,000 hours of annual volume or something like that. How can I take that 1,000 hours and rearrange it in a more intelligent way? And normally what that is it's concentrating more of the higher volume periods consecutively and more of the lower volume periods consecutively, so that there's some sort of super compensation that occurs, right, over long periods of time. And that's, once again, leveraging the fact that we know that endurance adaptations take weeks, several weeks to really sink in and not a week to sink in. So if I can string some of those big volume pieces together, some of the higher pieces of volume together, just with a different patterning, you usually can get, usually can have things be a little bit more effective. The next thing that I'll do, the kind of the big hammer home points, it really is very simple. Is I will ask the athlete, when were you training at your best? And when were you training at your worst? Those two endpoints. And everybody can immediately, you can think about your own training or your athlete's training or whatever. Most people can immediately resonate with those two endpoints. I sucked over here. Like, for whatever reason, I just couldn't get my shit together. Like, I was just terrible. But I was really good. This is when I was like setting PRs. I will take those two endpoints and I'll scrutinize the training that went around them. How much volume did you do? What was the intensity type? What was the intensity distribution? What kind of workouts did you do? And I'll do more of what worked and less of what didn't work. I know it's like, it really does. Like, this is why I'm saying we're if you start to chase the various systems and pendulums that come and swing around, where you start to go awry because you already have the individual pattern of the athlete in front of you through training history. Training history is so incredibly powerful because the future might not ever exactly repeat, but it sure as heck does rhyme. Hmm. And if you do a good job scrutinizing an athlete's previous training, either if you've been working with them for 3 or 4 years, or you're just taking them on as a new athlete and they have that robust of a training history, that pattern is incredibly powerful to leverage, and it doesn't have to be any more complicated than looking at the things that worked really well. And just, you don't have to do like double them. You could, but even if you just added 10% more.
Yeah.
And then doing less of the things that they said, which actually gained you training availability, if you think about it, right? So if they had a period of time where they were really terrible and you just avoid that, just avoiding the negative can actually be a big improvement for most athletes. The sequence of those two things, looking at the volume manipulation and then the when did you train really good and when did you train really, really poorly, that is going to be 95% of the manipulations that you can make as a coach. And you wouldn't have to do anything really all that differently. You could put in monitoring systems and physiological testing and all that other stuff, and that will certainly help around the fringes. But if you want to talk about fundamentals, you get those right and you are surefire as a coach, or if you're training yourself as an athlete, you are surefire going to continue to make improvements year after year because you can always iterate that process.
Yeah.
Right. Every year you go through, you can look at your volume. How can we do this differently? And then you can look at the, when was I doing great? When was I doing poorly? And then you can manipulate based off of that. It's not just a one-time thing. It's something that you can come back to annually.
So I kind of lied. I said I was going to let you go after that last question, but now I've got a follow-up question on that. So this I'm really curious about. So that's something I do too. Like I use WKO, and so I've like built charts. And when I take on somebody, I like have this one chart that's specifically just to like give me a review of their like last 3 years or whatever, you know, and there's things I look for, like you were saying, but I'm always really careful to, I might have somebody that they've been training, say 8 hours a week or 10 hours a week. But if I boil it down to just bike and mountain bike or something like that, it becomes more like 4 hours a week or five hours a week. Sure, and so, I mean, I've heard you talk about strength training with runners before and stuff like that. And so I'm just like, how do you manage that? Or like, are you, when you're looking at training volume, I'd have to imagine you're looking at run volume.
I look at the run volume. I mean, I do look at mode specific volume. So yeah. I have a lot of runners that do schemo in the winter, a lot of runners that use cycling as a cross training modality. I will kind of split it out, but when I talk about volume and specifically with how to manipulate the volume going forward, I am looking at the mode specific volume. So running for a runner, and a lot of runners that use cross training as a modality, sometimes you got to have a heavy conversation with the athlete and say, listen, we need to move 10% of your cross training volume over to running.
Yeah.
I know you like riding the bike. I know you like doing this. There's going to be a time and place for that, but let's just move some of it. Let's not move all of it. Let's just move some of it. Because once again, in the effort of volume matters, and when you can create an increase in volume, it will almost always result in an improvement in performance, not one to one, certainly not one to one. But if you can do that very easily just through manipulating the cross training modes, by all means go and do it. The triathletes are great at this, by the way. And a lot of that patterning that I get comes from my kind of like legacy coaching of working with a lot of triathletes, where we would look at, hey, listen, you need to improve on the bike. Your running is not going to get any better. Your swimming is not going to get any better. So let's take 10% of your run training availability and move it over to the bike. And let's take 10% of your swim availability and move it over to the bike. Done deal. Like, you're going to get improvement on the bike there, and then you get improvement across the entire sport. So once again, it's like a lesson learned from other sports that I can kind of bleed into the run side of things.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much. It certainly did not disappoint. So got some sound bites in there for sure. where can people find you on Instagram? And then what are your projects? You authored the, Training for Ultra Runners? Now, Training Essentials for Ultra Runners, which, like I said, is one of my favorite books. I go back to all the time. So I highly recommend it for cyclists too. And then what's the other project you have with the research that I can't remember the name right now?
Yeah, Training Essentials for Ultra Running. I'm really proud of that book. It's in its second version. I'm just amazed at the adoption of it. I couldn't see this at the time that I wrote the first edition, which was in 2016. But it'll be a title that kind of lives for 20 years. And I'm really kind of proud to have like laid the groundwork at it. It might not always be me that's the primary author behind it, but it's got enough of a legacy that I think it's got a very long tail associated with it. And it's available hardback directly from Amazon, softback directly from Amazon. You can buy it from my website. You can buy the audiobook, which I narrated. So if you want to listen to my voice anymore, you can hear it. And the audiobook's got some enhancements to it. I do some like podcast type interviews at the end of the chapters, which is kind of cool. Available on Kindle as well. And then I also, it's coming into its first year of existence. We have a research newsletter, which is honestly my favorite product that I put out every week. We have a team of Jim Rotberg, who you know, who's been my longtime colleague and co-writer or co-author for many years. Stephanie Howe, who has a PhD in exercise science and nutrition, is also one of our coaches, who is a technical reviewer for my book as well. And Nick Tiller, who has now carved himself out as the sports science skeptic. We meet as a team every single month or every single week. And monthly, we review three papers that are pertinent to ultramarathon running. And we really put these papers through the ringer from a scientific perspective, or Stephanie and Nick put them through the ringer. Jim Rutberg and myself, we just kind of stay out of the way and make sure we don't screw it up. But we put it through the scientific ringer and really evaluate the effectiveness of the methods and the statistics. And then we boil that all down into what are the practical takeaways, if there are any. And it's a really valuable product, because I know a lot of people here will read research, or they read the interpretation and, you know, Trail Running Magazine or Cycling Magazine or whatever. And a lot of times all it is an encapsulation of the results, right? Or the abstract. And we try to bring some of the more technical elements to light, particularly with the methods and the statistics, as I mentioned. And it's all wonderfully illustrated by Hilary Yang, who's just absolutely incredibly talented. Comes out on a monthly basis, three papers that are reviewed, and none of them are meant to be like, oh my god, this is the next greatest thing, like this is going to revolutionize my training. But over the course of time, and you know, as a coach, it's hard to keep up with the stuff. Over this course of time, if you take 15 or 20 minutes and read one of these a month, after a year, you now have a pretty robust body of information around a whole variety of subjects without having to go and cull the research yourself, which is very difficult because there's so much of it coming out. And this is one of the things that I've started to appreciate about this project, is just culling the research down to what is valuable and what is not takes a way better eye than I can even provide on it. Many times it takes me 20 or 30 minutes to look at something before I figure out that it's not worth looking at for some methodology consideration. Jesus, I'm having a hard time today. So anyway, people can go find out. It's on my website. I think it's a really good project. And then I am working on an AI coaching project. It's a little bit farther down the pipeline in terms of when it's going to see the light of day. And I don't know exactly what the final thing is going to be, but my initial take on it based on some of the use cases that we've kind of put through it makes me really bullish on it. I'm very excited about the technology, and I think that a lot of content that I have is kind of uniquely positioned to leverage the technology, and people will have a good time interacting with it.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. And I'm sure many people will love it and benefit from it. So.
I hate like previewing it right now, because it is, I don't know when this podcast is coming out, but it'll leave people on the, I mean, it needs some development. I mean, I'm not going to put it out there without it being pretty good. Yeah. I'm not saying that that's going to take 2 years, but it's definitely going to be, you know, midsummer or something like that before it starts to see the light of day.
Okay. That's sooner than I thought. So.
Yeah. You know, I'm lucky that I found very, very, very smart people to work with that, they can really help drive the product. I'm not a expert in machine learning or artificial intelligence, nor am I going to be. So I'm just very lucky that I'm able to find people where I can leverage their expertise.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you very much for your time, man. I appreciate it. And a pleasure as always.
Yeah, pleasure's all mine, man.
All right, take care. Hey, Dave here again. Thanks for listening. If you are enjoying Training Babble, please be sure to leave a rating and a review and share it with your friends. If there is something that you'd like to hear about or someone you'd like to hear from, send me a DM. Until next time.